Alright, this is really an amazing story. And I gotta give you the background to this story. Okay? Famous, famous story. This story, by the way, the background to this story is mentioned in the Machzor, in the prayer book that we use on Yom Kippur. Okay? It's the introduction, the beginning to one of the most powerful, passionate, and painful pieces in all of Jewish liturgy, called the Eile Ezkara. These are they that I will remember. The 10 martyrs and their true stories who were tortured by the Romans over a period of time, including Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael. Unbelievable stories. Okay? And you can visit, actually. You can visit Caesarea, Caesarea. Has anybody here been to Caesarea? Okay, right? Beautiful place. Have you been to the stadium there? The theater? Okay? That's where Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death. In that stadium. Okay, go there again, you'll see it's a different experience. Alright? If you go to Beit Shan, there's a stadium that's off the beaten track. It's not in the major tourist site, and that's where Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan was burned alive. Okay? And this is a very, very painful story. How is this story introduced? This story is introduced because the Caesar, the emperor, comes to these rabbis, calls them together, and says, what's the punishment for someone who sells his brother, kidnaps and sells his brother into slavery? And they say, death. And he says, well, the 10 greatest amongst you, right? The 10 brothers, 10 giants of men, the sons of Yaakov, sold their own brother into slavery. Were they ever punished? Did they ever have to pay the price? Obviously not. Someone has to bear the consequence. And therefore you, as the greatest of your generation, you will bear that pain, and very difficult. And how that happens, and how they accept the decree. Why is the story of Yosef being introduced in the middle of Yom Kippur? This is a very painful story. In fact, the most powerful line, there are a number of lines in the story of Yosef that are important, and I just want us all to be on the same page in terms of background so that we can study this. Okay? It's interesting. Yosef comes along, he's got his technicolor coat on, the brothers are jealous, or they conspire to kill him, or they think that he's deserving of death, depending on your perspective, right? They conspire, and they throw him in a pit. And you want to know the low point that we reached in Jewish history is the verse right after they throw him in the pit. You know what it says right after they throw him in the pit? It says, Vayeshvu le'echol lachem. And they sit down to eat. They're eating lunch. They throw their brother in a pit, and the next thing, could you pass the salt, please? If the 10 brothers can sit down by a pit and eat lunch, when Yosef, their brother, is crying out in agony, which becomes clear later on in the story when they're in Egypt, then something's wrong. Then the dream of a Jewish people that are going to become v'ahavta lo'echa kamocha, loving of their fellow like themselves, is going up in smoke. So they're going to need to spend 210 years in Egypt to learn what it means to be sensitive to your fellow human being. Very difficult. Okay? Now there are two major players in this story, besides Yosef. Okay? There is Reuven and there is Yehuda. Now Reuven is the oldest brother. He's the eldest. He's the leader. And when you look closely at the story, it looks, and I'm just giving you this as background, you can study this on your own if you want, it looks like Reuven really gets it. You know? Reuven is the one who says, basically, well, you know, let's throw him in a pit. Let's think about this. And according to the rabbis, Reuven comes back, he wants to save Yosef from the pit. And he leaves his brothers, and when he goes back to the pit, he's devastated to find that in the meantime, Yosef has disappeared because he's been sold into slavery. So it seems as though Reuven does a great thing. But if you look carefully at the verse where Reuven says this, right? What is the line that Reuven says when he sees that Yosef isn't in the pit? He says, V'hanar einenu, the boy is gone, V'ani ananiva. And I, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? He doesn't even call Yosef by name. Reuven's pain is not about Yosef. Reuven's pain is about Reuven. But of all the protagonists, of all the players in the story, the absolute worst is Yehuda. Because Yehuda is a leader. Yehuda has the potential for royalty. Yehuda is clearly the brother who is listened to by the other brothers, for whatever the reason. And Yehuda has history in his hands. Ma betza bidamo. What's the point in killing him? What are we going to gain from that? And he has their ear. And you can almost taste him saying, let's just take him back. We've scared him. He learned the lesson. But he doesn't go there. Here come the Ishmaelites. You know? So let's sell him. And he will spend the next 22 years regretting that decision. clearly. Yehuda is, when you really think about it, he's the one who sold his brother into slavery. Now that's amazing. And the most amazing part of that is that who is Yehuda? Yehuda is really the ancestor of King David. Yehuda is the source of royalty. Yehuda is the greatest of the brothers. And there are two pieces to think about. One is the potential for greatness. The greater the potential for greatness, the greater the potential for evil. You know? It's precisely because Yehuda has the potential for such greatness that the tragedy of what Yehuda did is so magnified. But of course, the second point is, so how does Yehuda get back? Because that's really our question. If you can go from selling your brother into slavery to being the progenitor of royalty for the Jewish people forever, then somehow you found your way back. And it's fascinating to me. Jewish leadership is not about purity. It's not about, I never made a mistake. Not at all. You know, if you look into the roots, as we're going to see in a minute, Jewish leadership begins in the gutter. You know, the ancestor of King David is Ruth. And Ruth comes from the nation of Moab. And Moab is the illegitimate son of Lot and his daughter who commits incest with him. You know, there's an old line from a Yiddish proverb, you know, that Jesus was born of an immaculate conception. There's a fundamental difference in the Christian idea of messianism and the Jewish idea of messianism. You know, Jesus was so pure, he's even part of an immaculate conception. That's why he gets to the world, he can't stay here, he has to come back later. Right? The Jewish Mashiach, on the other hand, is born in the muck. He's very much in the world and of it. So the question is, how does Yehuda get from being all the way there to being all the way down there and then get back again? If I could figure this out, if I could learn from this story, then I would discover something much more valuable than how to never sin. Because that's not real. I might actually discover what to do when I do fall into the pit, when I do make mistakes. And that is the story of Yehuda, and that's where we pick this up. So this is the verse immediately following the sale of Joseph. They sell Joseph, Joseph goes to the house of Potiphar, and this is the next verse. So let's read this together. Vayehi ba'etahi. Vayehi, by the way, is a language that always represents pain. Whenever you see that word, and behold it was, that is always a language of pain. Every famine starts with this word. Every tragedy in the Bible starts with this word. Something's about to go wrong. Vayehi ba'etahi, in that time, right after the selling of Joseph, vayered Yehuda me'etechav. And Yehuda goes down from amongst his brothers. If you can sell your brother into slavery, then you're going down. You know? You can't walk away from that. That has to rip you apart. Vayet ad ish adulami ushmo chira. So he goes to make his tent, maybe to do business, with an adulamite, a Canaanite, named Chira. Vayal sham Yehuda bat ish knani, and he sees the daughter of a Canaanite man. Ushmo Shua, and his name is Shua. Vayikachea vayavo elea. Now vayikachea kicha is generally the language of marriage. He marries her. This is the first intermarriage. And through everything Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov went through. What Avram went through to make sure that his son Yitzchak didn't marry from the local Canaanite girls all the way to the house of Lavan to marry Rivka. What Yitzchak goes through, sending Yaakov all the way to the house of Lavan so that he will find Rachel and Leah. All of that work undone by Yehuda. Yehuda marries a Canaanite. I want you to know, one of the things I love most about the Torah, we don't whitewash our heroes. This is a very difficult story. Okay. Vatav Vatele Ben, so she gets pregnant and has a son, and calls his name Er. I want you to know, Er is a very, very strange name, because it basically means cursed. That's one understanding of that name. It's a very strange name, right? Oh, cursed one, come here. Look, cursed one's walking, right? It's almost as though this is what Yehuda sees himself as. He's forced to leave his family, not by any external factor, but by who he is. He's ashamed of himself. Vatarot, she has another son. Vatelet ben. Vatikrat shmo Onan. Now Onan, there are different opinions as to what the word Onan means. Okay? One understanding is Ani, Ana, Ani, Ba. Right? This is, who am I? Who am I? Now you listen to your older brother cursed. Okay? These are strange names. And they obviously reflect something. Okay? Vatosev od, vatelet ben, she has a third son. Vatikrat shmo Shela. Okay? Kishalyani, another language of curse. Okay? Two cursed children, and a who am I? Right? This is where Yehuda is. Okay? So he has three boys. So now Yehuda takes a woman for his oldest son, Er, Ushma Tamar, and her name is Tamar. Okay? So they have a big party because now he's got a daughter-in-law. But Er, the firstborn of Yehuda, is evil in the eyes of God. And God kills him. Now that may be, you know, sort of something supernatural going on, or that may be the language of the Torah for, he died. No children, he died. And it could be that the way the Torah looks at that is, if he died young without children, he must have done something wrong. Or it could be that there's actually stuff he did wrong that we know about that the Torah doesn't tell us. What's important to me to know now is twofold. Number one, the Torah doesn't view it as important right now to know what he did. Okay? Just that he did. He did evil in the eyes of God, and not in the eyes of man. In the eyes of God. Not clear what that is. A lot of different opinions. Okay? The Medrash is full of sexual innuendos here, of things that he was doing that were evil in the eyes of God. Right? Children with animals, I'll spare you the details. Right? This is the son of Yehuda. Er is the grandson of Yaakov. He's born, he lives, he marries, he dies, and there's nothing. No mention of his grandfather, no mention of spirituality, no accomplishments he has. See to what a depth Yehuda has sunk. Vayomer Yehuda Leonan Boel Eshet Achicha. But the right thing to do in those days was that if a boy died without children, right? So his wife was promised to the next in line. Now you have to understand, marriage as we understand it today is somewhat different from the way marriage was in the time of the Torah. Okay? This is a very interesting thing. And I'll give you one example. Alright? You know, back then, men married more than one woman. I once read a very interesting article on this by a professor named Sperber, who suggests that they've done studies to discover that there were four times as many women in the world back then as there were men. Okay? Now this makes a lot of sense. Between wars, the fact that men went out in the world and therefore they contracted diseases that women weren't exposed to, and all sorts of other reasons. Okay? Now if you're a woman, and you have no husband back in biblical times, you're defenseless. You know, marriage wasn't just about love, right? Marriage was a place where you had a home, where you were protected, where you could raise children, where you could feel you had a purpose in the world. So if a woman didn't get married, she was cursed. So therefore, for a man to marry four women was actually the opportunity to give blessing to four women. Personally, I don't know how they did that. It's enough work to marry to one woman, but okay, right? So the right thing to do then is that this girl who has been married to my son, who is now bereft of home and children, she's promised to the next in line. And even though to our minds this seems very strange, this was actually part of an ethical system. And you find this, by the way, in different, because this is before the Torah was given, you find this in Mugrabi and in Mesopotamian law and whatever it is, fine. So he concubines her. In other words, she becomes now betrothed to this brother and married to him as the wife of his brother who died. And bring seed forth for your brother. In other words, that his name shouldn't be lost. Now Onen understands that when he has a child, this child will be named in memory of his brother. It won't be his child, it'll be his brother's child. How that works spiritually, mystically, we don't have time for. And Onen knows this. And he doesn't want this. The idea of giving a son to the world that isn't his, that's anathema to Onen. So if he comes to his brother's wife, so he threw his seed on the ground, in order not to give seed to his dead brother. Do you understand this? The modern Hebrew word, and you know, fortunately we don't have a teenage group here, the modern Hebrew word, okay, for masturbation is le'onen. I love the fact that even the darkest parts of Judaism are based on biblical stories. I think that's unbelievable. Because that's onen, that's who he was. He spills his seed in vain. Can you imagine the cruelty of such an act that you have a woman who was married, whose brother dies, and now she has the chance to rebuild a family, but you don't want to give her that satisfaction of rebuilding her brother, your brother's family, so you'd rather spill your seed in vain. The essence of the act of spilling your seed in vain is selfishness. That's the difference between love and lust, right? Lust is all about taking. It's just about the physical act. It's not about building a spiritual world. So what do you think is going to happen to Onan if he's spilling his seed in vain? What do you think is going to happen to him? Okay, he's going to buy it too. So Yehuda loses son number two. Vayira b'nei Hashem asher asa v'yamad gamato. So Hashem kills him too. Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar kalato. So Yehuda says to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, right? Shvi almana beit avich. Sit as a widow in your father's home. Ad yigdal shela b'nei, until the third son Shela grows up. Ki amar pen yamut gam hu k'echav. Because Yehuda says to himself, listen, this woman's a black widow. I mean, she's killing off my boys here. You know, once fooled, twice challenged, three, I'm not a chump. So you go live with your dad, and well, you know, Shella's a youngster, he's got to grow up a little, we'll get there. And he's thinking, I got to figure out a way out of this. So Tamar goes, and she lives in her father's home. And many days pass. And the wife of Yehuda dies. And Yehuda is comforted, or changes, or relents, or whatever it might be. So now they're on the road, they're going to Timnah, him and his Canaanite buddy. And someone tells Tamar, look, you know, I just saw Yehuda, your father-in-law. He's going up to Timnah to do the sheep. Can you imagine? This girl, who has been married twice, lost both husbands, who was supposed to have the opportunity to be betrothed to the youngest boy, it's not happening. And she's starting to smell the writing on the wall. See the writing on the wall, hear the writing on the wall, whatever, right? Mixed metaphors, right? She's getting it. Nobody's running to make wedding bells for the black widow. So look what she does. This is an unbelievable story. Fatasa Bigdeal Minutan. Now she has to live in mourning clothes. Because she's not only is she not given to Shela, right? But she can't marry anybody else because she's betrothed to Shela. You understand? This woman is stuck. She can't go find anyone else because she has the responsibility of reclaiming the brothers' names that were lost. So she finally decides enough is enough. She throws off her black widow clothes, breaks the law. And she covers herself with a scarf. And she goes, she puts on the miniskirt, you know, and she hangs on the rice beads. Maybe she puts on a wig. Maybe she practices all morning in the mirror going like this. Whatever it is, right? I don't know. And she's gonna go hang out, and she sits on the floor in a very suggestive way. Because Shela's grown up. Nobody's given her over to him. Yehuda sees her. And he thinks that she is a zonah. Now the word zonah has two possibilities. Rachav, in the times of Joshua, if you know the story, is also called a zonah. There is one opinion that it says that zonah comes from the language of mazon, of food. She was an innkeeper. All the other authorities say, what does it mean? It means she was a prostitute, a harlot. Okay? The oldest profession in the world, here it is. That is pshat. That's how I look at the story, but you can definitely disagree, there are different opinions. So he thinks that she's a prostitute. Now the Torah isn't given yet, and he's not married anymore. So, you know, it's barter. She needs to eat. He needs whatever he needs. So they do a barter exchange. Legal. Okay. Not exactly royal material here. Okay. So, Vayechshevel is ona, kikistapanea. He thinks that she's a harlot because she's covered her face. Vayet elea la derech. So he kind of like moseys onto the side of the road. Vayomer havana voileich. Okay, this is the original words of havana gila, but not quite that way. Havana avoileich. Come now, let me come to you. Okay, you can all figure out what that means. Ki lo yadaki kalatohi. He did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Oh, that's much better. Well, he didn't know she was his daughter-in-law. So he's sleeping with a harlot by the road. If he would have known she was his daughter-in-law, he never would have done it. Okay. Vatomel matitenli. So she says, okay, well, you know, what are you going to give me? I mean, you know, this ain't for free. This ain't a market here. Vayomer anochi eshlach gdi ziminatzon. I will send you a sheep from my flock. I'll pay you with a sheep from the flock. Right, that's like the moment where the feds run in, because now it's an official exchange, right? She says, look, honey, You know, I've been around the block before. You're going to send me a sheep one day. Give me some collateral. How do I know I'm going to get the sheep? What collateral should I give to you? Give me your signet ring. Give me your ptilima, a certain way that you tied your bundles. That's one opinion. Basically, this is like your talis bag. Umatcha, and your staff. These are all objects that are very personal objects. You know, if you have a walking stick, you'll recognize your walking stick, right? Vayitenla, so he gives it to her. Vayavoileh, and he comes to her. Vatalo, and she becomes pregnant. Now, even though in the verse this is one after another, you can imagine that some time has passed before she knows she's pregnant. He's gone. Vatakam vatelech vatasar tzifeh me'aleah vatilbash bigdei almanuta. Okay, and she gets back into her widow's clothes. Now, you and I know that if a man and a woman come together, the pregnancy occurs immediately. We kind of think of this thing of like 2 weeks later, 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later. But understand that biologically this is an immediate thing. That's what the pasuk says. She's pregnant now. She doesn't even know she's pregnant. But she goes back to her widow's clothes. And this raises a very interesting question. What was she trying to accomplish? Was she trying to accomplish that she wanted intimacy? Was she trying to accomplish that the possibility exists that she would have children? Was she trying to accomplish that clearly it was not her fault that they weren't having children if she could indeed become pregnant? Not at all clear. Most of the commentaries, and I want you to know if you want my opinion, this is the one that makes the most sense to me, is that she wants to bring children into the world. Okay? Let's assume for the moment that I'm right. Okay? That ultimately she wants a child. Because she understands the clock is ticking, and pretty soon she's not going to be able to have children. Now, if Tamar wants to have a child, that's a very interesting question. Does she want to have a child because she just wants a child? In which case, this act is all about her. Or does she want the child because a woman, ultimately, has within her makeup the ability to give life to the world? There is no greater act of giving than the ability to give life. Man, on a certain level, participates in the creation of life as an act of passion. It's much less a process of decision-making. But a woman, when you really stop to think about it, and this is, of course, one of the big issues today, especially in the world and in America, a woman has 9 months to think about whether she wants to give that life to the world. Right? And you would imagine that if a woman gets pregnant, and it's her father-in-law that got her pregnant, and as you'll see, the consequence of this is very severe, she has a lot of motivation to get rid of that child. And even back then, that was possible. So I'm going to assume, and I definitely could be wrong, this is something to think about, I'm going to assume that she does this because she wants to bring life into the world, which means that her action is purely about giving. Yehuda, on the other hand, has no interest in that whatsoever. His act is completely about taking. Do you understand the contrast? The contrast. Tamar, the Canaanite daughter-in-law, is about to teach Yehuda how far he's fallen. Yehuda has forgotten that life is supposed to be about giving. So now Tamar is back in her black widow clothing, which means that she's the daughter-in-law again of Yehuda. Vayishlach Yehuda et k'diezim. Now Yehuda's an ethical fellow. He promised a goat. He's going to send it. So he sends the goat, Biad Re'ehu, in his Adulamite friend, Canaanite friend, the kind of guy you can trust to send the goat to a harlot because no problem. Lakachat Heiravon, because he wants back his bail. Interesting. He's not sending the goat because he knows that he owes this woman a goat. He's sending the goat because he wants his collateral back. It's all about Yehuda. He's taking. He's still taking. V'lo mitzah, but they can't find her. V'yishal tanshei mekomah. So they ask in that neighborhood, lemor hayah k'deishahi. Where is that woman? The word k'deisha, by the way, which also means a harlot, is a very powerful word. We don't have time right now, but suffice it to say, what word does the word k'deisha remind you of? Kedusha. Now what is Kedusha? Kedusha is? Fine. So what is holiness? So, right? We all know what it is. It's holiness. What's on the moon, right? Holiness, Kedusha, okay, the definition of an item as Kadosh is that it has become a vehicle for bringing me closer to God. That's what makes something Kadosh. The opposite of Kadosh, which is Chol, what we mistranslate as secular, is that which distances me from God. Okay? This can become kadosh if it becomes a part of my journey to develop a relationship with God, like when I make a blessing over it. Wine can be chol, it can send me into the gutter, or wine can be kadosh, it can elevate my experience and bring me closer to God. And we can talk about that sometime. Alright? She is now called a Kadesha. Before she was a Zona. Zona definitely relates to the word Mazon, because it's all about what I can take. Kadesha, that's a whole different level. The Torah is telling me that Tamar is in this for the right reasons. It doesn't necessarily mean she did the right thing, but she's in it for the right reasons. That's a powerful word. Okay? Alright, so they can't find her. Right? Be'einayim al aderech, she with the magical eyes on the road, right? Because she has this scarf, but she's like, you know, whatever she's doing with her eyes, right? We didn't see, we don't know what you're talking about. I love that line. I love that line. Is that line mean that everybody says, oh, I don't know? Or everybody says, I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Vayashav el Yuda, vayom el lomit satia. So he comes back to you, this buddy of his, I can't find her. They can't find her either. You have to find her peniel avuz. Again, not take her the goat because we owe her the goat. Take her the goat because my collateral is going to show up and this is going to look bad. We're going to be embarrassed. I sent the goat and you can't find her. And then they forget about it. Because it's not high on you, it's priority. And it becomes known to Yuda, it's told to him, Zanta Tamar Kalatech, your daughter-in-law Tamar has become a harlot. Because that's how people view her. And she's pregnant Liznunim. She's pregnant with an illegitimate child. Because remember, she's betrothed to your son Shela. Okay? She's betrothed. Betrothal, erusin, okay, if you know what that word means, in those days meant that you were committed. You were. Did we have this discussion about erusin and nisuin? I don't remember, no? So erusin, engagement, isn't like today. Right? Today, engagement means now I have to think about whether I'm getting married. In those days, engagement meant I was actually going to get married. It's a radical thought. Okay, right? But you were forbidden to everybody else. Okay? And in fact, if in the traditional form of engagement, which we today do actually under the chuppah at the wedding, the reason we do it under the wedding is because if you get an official engagement, you need a get. You need a divorce document to undo that. Just like a marriage. The only difference between being engaged and being married is that while in both cases you're now forbidden as a woman to anybody else, right? In engagement, you're still forbidden to your husband. There's a state of being where you're forbidden to everybody else and you're still physically forbidden to your husband. So you're now committed to a person without being physically involved with him. You actually have this period of time where you get to know somebody. It's a radical idea. For another time. Okay? So she is basically an adulteress. So, take her out and burn her. Ah, the good old days when life was so simple, right? Okay. Oh, I'm going to hell for this class. Okay. Right? Hotzi yovati tzeif, let her be burnt. V'hi mutzat, so she's found. V'hi shalchal chamia lemor. And so she sends to her father-in-law. She doesn't even call him Yuda. La'ish asher eile lo anochi hara. To he, to whom these belong, am I pregnant. Vatomer, and she says to Yehuda, because one opinion is they bring her before him, and one opinion is that she just sends it with a messenger. Haker na lemi hachotemet v'aptilim v'amateila. Whomsoever these belong to, that's who made me pregnant. Now this is a powerful line. By the way, this word, haker na, we found this somewhere else in the Torah. This was in the previous chapter. When the boys take the coat of Yosef and dip it in the blood of an ox and bring it to their father Yaakov to prove to him that Yosef has been killed, so they don't have to answer all these questions, they say to Yaakov, Hakerna lemi ha'aktonet hazeh, recognize to whom this coat belongs. And now Yehuda is hearing the same words. Yehuda understands. This is a cycle here. He's being put where he was before. And whenever you see the same phrase used again, usually it means that there's an opportunity for tikkun, for fixing. Yehuda has the opportunity to begin the long, painful process of fixing the mistake that he made. Whose are these? And if you want to know, when Yehuda, the promiscuous one, Yehuda, the kidnapper, Yehuda, the potential murderer, becomes Yehuda the king, when his march, his journey to royalty begins, is in this moment. Because what is the natural thing for Yehuda to do? The natural thing for Yehuda to do? I don't know. Yehuda's a judge. According to the rabbis, there was a judge, there was a court, there was a Beit Din, and Yehuda, as one of the older sons, sat on the court. And who's this? She's a woman, a daughter-in-law, who's pregnant, a harlot. Who are you going to believe? Especially back in, 1200 BCE, right? But that's not what Yehuda does. Vayomer Yehuda, right? Vayaker Yehuda, vayomer tzadka mimeni. She is more righteous than I. Those are two of the most powerful words that you will find in the entire Torah. This is the first instance where Yehuda, mimeni, from me, she is more righteous than me, but it also means she is more righteous from me. Yehuda is now ready to start giving. Ki al kein lo netati al shela, because I didn't give her a shela, v'lo yasaf od l'data, and he has no more relations with her. Which is, by the way, a whole other discussion. V'hi ba'et l'data, and when she gives birth, and it's a longer story, she has twins, one of those twins, there are two of them being born, one of them sticks out his hand, right? Zarach, and the nursemaid ties a red string around him, right? Shani. And then all of a sudden he pulls his hand back in, and out pops the other one. And the nursemaid says, Ma paratz ta peretz, where'd you jump out? Where'd you burst from? Because he doesn't have the thing on. Because the first one stuck his hand out. And so he's called Peretz. And Peretz is the ancestor of David. Do you understand this? From incest is born Mashiach. Because no matter how far down in the gutter you get, the ability to begin to turn things around, the ability to take this and to understand where it can go, that is the beginning of redemption. So there are a lot of things to learn from this story. Before we get there, because we only have 5 minutes, any questions?
What happened to Shelah?
Pardon? Shelah becomes part of the dynasty of Yehuda, but he is not royalty. In fact, it's very interesting, if you think about it, there are two stories of twins that are clearly in the Torah. There's a third, which is Cain and Hevel, but whatever. Right now, one of them, Yaakov and Esav, what happens? Yaakov comes out holding the heel of Esav. In this story, okay, one of them pushes the other out of the way who stuck his hand in. The hand is almost the opposite of the heel. There are two stories here that are juxtaposed to each other. Okay? It is the hand that leads to royalty. It's a very interesting discussion about what the hand is, the hand of giving or the hand of taking. Royalty is about taking the same energy and turning it around. That's what Malchut is all about. Right? In fact, when you change your mind, one of the words for changing your mind is Malach. Okay? Nimlach, he changed his mind. Because Malchut is the ability, Malchut royalty, we have this image, in the world, so royalty you're born into, and that's true. But in Judaism, it's a combination of birth and merit. Because there are lots of different sons. And every story of royalty in the Torah that is legitimate royalty, right, is a chosen king. It's very interesting. Okay? Because royalty is about being able to take what you're given and turn it around to build of it something great. Yes? He didn't marry her. The child is very illegitimate. The child is absolutely legitimate. Well, isn't that interesting? Because she's his daughter-in-law. She can't marry his daughter-in-law. Ah, now that's a very interesting question. Is she then given over to the third son? You want to hear the most amazing thing? Now, the Torah doesn't tell me. And if the Torah doesn't tell me, it means it's not critical to what we have to learn from the Torah. But the rabbis have a field day with this. In halacha, okay, in Jewish law, post-Sinai, Kedushin, whatever, right? If a father-in-law was to sleep, never mind a father-in-law, if a wife adulters, okay, and just to be clear, the definition of adultery is not the definition that you get out of a Hollywood movie. It's not just that someone slept with someone, it's whether they are witnesses and whether they're such. It's a very complex thing. So don't assume that, it's not a simple question. Like I said, nobody should walk out of here with any form of halachic ruling. These are very difficult, very challenging questions. They affect families, they affect marriages, so don't walk out with a misperception. But in dry halacha, if a man's wife adulters and sleeps with somebody else, he is no longer allowed to marry her. And if they're still married, he has to divorce her. It's one of the most painful halachot in Judaism. Very difficult. Right? So now she has now adultered with her father-in-law. So that means that she can't remain betrothed to Shelah, and he can't have relations with her. She is now stuck. Do you understand? She's willing to give up whatever marriage represents in order to bring a life into the world. That's very powerful when you stop to think about it. Pardon? Her child becomes the ancestor of royalty. Now, on a mystical level, she must have, they must have done something right. I'll give you, by the way, the other example. Because the other side of the story of David, if you look at the lineage of David, and you can see, by the way, if you want to see the exact lineage of King David, look at the end of the book of Ruth. At the end of the book of Ruth, which interestingly enough we read on Shavuot, okay? The end of the book of Ruth defines the lineage from Ruth, really from Judah, all the way down to David. And one of the ancestors of David is Boaz, who was Ruth's husband, okay? Now Ruth was a Moabitess. And like I told you before, Moab was born because when Lot leaves Sodom, right, his daughters, okay, the older one and the younger one is all we know of them, right, they don't know that this is just a local event. Because the only other event that's close to the total destruction of Sodom and Amorah is which major event, which major cataclysm? The flood. So they think the world is destroyed. So the older one says to the younger one, Nechayem Avinu Zara. There's no more men left in the world. We have to bring life into this world, so we have to sleep with our father. So they get their father drunk, Lot, and they sleep with him. Okay? And he has, each one of them becomes pregnant, and he has two sons, Ammon and Moab. Now, putting aside for a moment the question of getting so drunk that you can sleep with your daughter, I'm not going to go there, but Moab is the ultimately illegitimate son. Do you understand this? He is Lot's son and his grandson. That's one side of the Davidic lineage. And the other side is Peretz, who comes from Tamar, who slept with her father-in-law. That's such a powerful message. It's such a powerful message. David comes from the gutter. But Judaism believes that if you're willing to turn the gutter around, you can. Now, don't get me wrong. He also comes from Yaakov. He also comes from Yehuda. But that's a very powerful message. He is not the Immaculate Conception by any shape or form. Yes. Right. In a post-Sinai world, just to explain what you just asked, in a post-Sinai world, okay, and we don't have this anymore for various reasons, but there's a whole tractate in the Talmud called Yevamos. If a brother dies and he has no children, and he has a brother, okay, that brother is meant to have relations with the original, his sister-in-law. She's supposed to become his wife. Actually, she's called a Levirate. She's not quite a wife. She's not quite a concubine. What the differences are is interesting, right? And it's a tremendous mitzvah that he performs, that his brother's memory should be remembered, that she should not go childless, etc. And there's a whole process. Now, what you're referring to is that brother, that living brother, can decide, I don't want to do it. He can refuse. And according to tradition, it's not a good thing to do. You know, and she takes off her shoe, and she spits in the shoe, and she's basically saying to him, you loser, right, you disgustingness. And then there's this whole chain, if the brother doesn't do it, so you go to the cousin, if the cousin doesn't do it, you go to the nephew. There's a whole sort of chain of command of lineage. Boaz is actually not next in line. One of the closer relatives to the dead husband of Ruth, right, should have married Ruth, didn't want to, and therefore they do this ceremony, and Boaz gets to marry her. Okay, I don't know about you, but I could discuss this for hours. It's a fascinating story. I want to remind you that one of the goals that we set for this series is that you should walk away with different discussions. I cannot begin to tell you what an amazing experience it is to take these stories, Yosef, Tamar, Yehuda, whatever, to sit down with whoever you want to learn with before Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh El during that month, and to have this discussion, okay? But what I think is most important to walk away from this is we're on a journey. We're on a journey. We're deep within a tapestry, you know? And we're in the midst of that journey. We've passed into Tammuz. We're a week away from this day, you know? And it's a heavy day, the 17th of Tammuz. It's a fast day. We're going to go to Har Herzl, which is also an incredible experience, National Military Cemetery. And for those of you that are coming, I'm going to actually take you from Yad Vashem to the military cemetery to tell you some of the stories of some of my experiences and some of the guys that I know who were killed, and we're going to go to one of their graves. But we get so stuck in that moment that we don't realize it's part of a process. The 17th of Tammuz was a going down. But when you look back at this story, it's because Yehuda went down that he was ready to climb back up. He needed to sink into that hole. So this is as much a part of the journey as this is. I asked you whether we're better off having never experienced this, or whether we're lucky enough to have had that experience with the broken tablets. I'll tell you something interesting. When we finally bring down the whole tablets, and then we build a tabernacle, which at least according to one commentary was the consequence of the sin of the golden calf, we needed to reestablish our relationship with God and build a mishkan, a tabernacle, the predecessor of the temple. So there was an ark, right? And the ark was inside the Holy of Holies. And you know what was in the ark? The tablets. Both sets. The whole tablets and the broken tablets. Because I think what that might mean is that we need to keep our broken tablets as well. All the experiences in life, our mistakes as they were, you know, the pieces of life that seem to break us, that they're there to make us stronger. They're an enormous gift if we will but learn to harness their energy. So we take our broken tablets and we put them into the ark along with the new ones. Okay? And that is this journey. And as we get closer and closer to Elul, when we hit the middle of Av in August, and all of a sudden we're 2 weeks away, we're at the beginning of the planting of the seeds. And then we get to the month of Elul, which is the taking root of the opportunity for change. You know? And you just watch this whole journey, this tapestry develop, like a tree that's starting to grow and flower. Okay? So God willing, tomorrow we're going to start talking about Rosh Hashanah.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.